There was a glow of dawn in the sky when Vimes strode out, but the city was still a pattern of shadows. In his pocket was the reassuring heaviness of the badge, and in his mind the huge, huge freedom of the oath. Ruler after ruler had failed to notice what a devious oath it was. He walked as steadily as he could down to Twinkle Street. A couple of watchmen tried to waylay him, but he showed them the badge, and more importantly, he had the voice now. It had come back to him. It was night, and he was walking the streets, and he owned the damn streets, and somehow that came out in the way he spoke. They'd hurried off. He wasn't sure they'd believed him, but at least they'd pretended to. The voice had told them he could be the kind of trouble they weren't paid enough to deal with. At one point, he had to step aside as a very thin horse dragged a huge and familiar four-wheeled wagon over the cobbles. Frightened faces looked out at him from between the wide metal strips that covered most of it, and then it disappeared into the gloom. Curfew was claiming its nightly harvest. These were not good times. Everyone knew Lord Winder was insane, and then some kid who was equally mad had tried to knock him off, and would have done too, if the man hadn't moved at the wrong moment. His lordship had taken the arrow in the arm, and they said, they being the nameless people of the kind that everyone met in the pub, that the wound had poisoned him and made him worse. He suspected everyone and everything. He saw dark assassins in every corner. The rumour was that he woke up sweating every night because they even got into his dreams. And he saw plots and spies everywhere throughout his waking hours, and had men root them out. And the thing about rooting out plots and spies everywhere is that, even if there are no real plots to begin with, there are plots and spies galore very soon. At least the Night Watch didn't have to do much of the actual rooting. They just arrested the pieces. It was the special office in Cable Street that was the long hand of his lordship's paranoia. The particulars, they were, officially. But as far as Vimes could remember, they'd revelled in their nickname of the Unmentionables. They were the ones that listened in every shadow and watched at every window. That was how it seemed, anyway. They certainly were the ones who knocked on doors in the middle of the night. Vimes stopped in the dark. The cheap clothes were soaked through, the boots were flooded, rain was trickling off his chin, and he was a long, long way from home. Yet, in a treacherous kind of way, this was home. He'd spent most of his days working nights. Walking through the wet streets of a sleeping city was his life. The nature of the night changed, but the nature of the beast remained the same. He reached into the ragged pocket and touched the badge again. In the darkness, where lamps were few and far between, Vimes knocked on a door. A light was burning in one of the lower windows, so Lorne was presumably still awake. After a while, a very small panel slid back, and he heard a voice say, "Oh, it's you." There was a pause, followed by the sound of bolts being released. The doctor opened the door. In one hand, he held a very long syringe. Vimes found his gaze inexorably drawn to it. A bead of something purple dripped off the end and splashed onto the floor. "What would you have done? Inject me to death?" he said. "This?" Lorne looked at the instrument as if unaware he'd been holding it. "Oh, just sorting out a little problem for someone. Patients turn up at all hours."
"I'll bet they do."
"Rosie said you had a spare room," said Vimes. "I can pay," he added quickly. "I've got a job. $5 a month? I won't be needing it for long."
"Upstairs on the left," said Lorne, nodding. "We can talk about it in the morning."
"I'm not a criminal madman," said Vimes. He wondered why he said it, and then wondered who he was trying to reassure.
"Never mind, I'm sure you'll soon fit in," said Lorne.
There was a whimper from the door leading to the surgery.
"The bed's not aired, but I doubt that you'll care," he said. "And now, if you'll excuse me."
It wasn't aired, and Vimes didn't care. He didn't even remember getting into it. He woke up once in panic and heard the sound of the big black wagon rattling down the street. And then it just, quite seamlessly, became part of the nightmare. At 10 o'clock in the morning, Vimes found a cold cup of tea by his bed and a pile of clothes and armour on the floor outside the door. He drank the tea while he inspected the pile. He'd read Snouty right. The man survived because he was a weathercock and kept an eye on which way the wind was blowing, and right now the wind was blowing due Vimes. He'd even included fresh socks and drawers, which hadn't been in the specification. It was a thoughtful touch. They probably hadn't been paid for, of course. They had been obtained. This was the old Night Watch. But glory be, the breathy little crawler had scrounged something else too. The three stripes for a sergeant had a little gold crown above them. Vimes instinctively disliked crowns,
but this one he was prepared to treasure. He went downstairs doing up his belt, and bumped into Lorne coming out of his surgery, wiping his hands on a cloth. The doctor smiled absently, then focused on the uniform. The smile did not so much fade as drain. "Shocked?" said Vimes.
"Surprised," said the doctor. "Rosie won't be, I expect. I don't do anything illegal, you know."
"Then you've got nothing to fear," said Vimes.
"Really? That proves you're not from around here," said Lorne. "Want some breakfast? There's kidneys."
This time it was Vimes's smile that drained.
"Lamb," the doctor added.
In the tiny kitchen he prized the lid off a tall stone jar and pulled out a can. Vapour poured off it.
"Ice," he said.
"Get it from over the road. Keeps food fresh." Vimes's brow wrinkled.
"Over the road? You mean the mortuary?"
"Don't worry, it's not been used," said Lorne, putting a pan on the stove.
"Mr. Garnish drops off a lump a few times a week in payment for being cured of a rather similar medical condition."
"But mostly you work for the ladies of, shall we say, negotiable affection," said Vimes.
Lorne gave him a sharp look to see if he was joking, but Vimes's expression hadn't changed.
"Not just them," he said. "There are others."
"People who come in by the back door," said Vimes, looking around the little room. "People who, for one reason or another, don't want to go to the better-known doctors?"
"Or can't afford them," said Lorne.
"People who turn up with no identity. And you had a point, John."
"No, no, just asking," said Vimes, cursing himself for walking right into it.
"I just wondered where you trained."
"Why?"
"The kind of people who come in by the back door are the kind of people who want results, I imagine."
"Ha! Well, I trained in Clatch. They have some novel ideas about medicine over there. They think it's a good idea to get patients better, for one thing."
He turned over the kidneys with a fork.
"Frankly, Sergeant, I'm pretty much like you. We do what needs doing. We work in unpopular areas, and I suspect we both draw the line somewhere. I'm no butcher. Rosie says you aren't. But you do the job that's in front of you, or people die."
"I'll remember that," said Vimes.
"And when all's said and done," said Lorne, "there are worse things to do in the world than take the pulse of women."
After breakfast, Sergeant-at-Arms John Keel stepped out into the first day of the rest of his life. He stood still for a moment, shut his eyes, and swiveled both feet like a man trying to stub out two cigarettes at once. A slow, broad smile spread across his face. Snouty had found just the right kind of boots. Willikins and Sybil between them conspired to prevent him wearing old, well-worn boots those days, and stole them away in the night to have the soles repaired. It was good to feel the streets with dry feet again, and after a lifetime of walking them, he did feel the streets. There were the cobblestones, cat heads, troll heads, loaves, short and long sets, rounders, Morpork sixes, and the 87 types of paving brick, and the 14 types of stone slab, and the 12 types of stone never intended for street slabs but which had got used anyway, and had their own patterns of wear, and the rubbles, and the gravels, and the repairs, and the 13 different types of cellar cover, and 20 types of drain lid. He bounced a little, like a man testing the hardness of something.
"Elm Street," he said. He bounced again.
"Junction with Twinkle."
"Yeah."
He was back. It wasn't many steps to Treacle Mine Road, and as he turned towards the watch house, a flash of colour caught his eye. And there it was, overhanging a garden wall. Lilac was common in the city. It was vigorous and hard to kill, and had to be. The flower buds were noticeably swelling. He stood and stared, as a man might stare at an old battlefield. "They rise, hands up, hands up, hands up." How did it go now? Think of things happening one after the other. Don't assume that you know what's going to happen, because it might not. Be yourself. And, because he was himself, he made a few little purchases in little shops in dark alleys, and went to work. The Treacle Mine Road night watch house was generally deserted around midday, but Vimes knew that Snouty at least would be there. He was a persistent floater, just like Nobby and Colon and Carrot, and when you got down to it, Vimes as well. Being on duty was their default state of being. They hung around the watch house even when off duty, because that's where their lives took place. Being a copper wasn't something you left hanging by the door when you went home.
"'But I promise I'll learn how,' thought Vimes. "'When I get back, it'll all be different.' He went around the back and let himself in by the stable entrance. It wasn't even locked. Black mark right there, lads. The iron bulk of the hurry-up wagon stood empty on the cobbles. Behind it was what they called now the stables. In fact, the stables were only the bottom floor of what would have been part of Ankh Morpork's industrial heritage, if anyone had ever thought of it like that. In practice, they thought of it as junk that was too heavy to cart away. It was part of the winding gear from a treacle mine, long since abandoned. One of the original lifting buckets was still up there, glued to the floor by its last load of the heavy, sticky, unrefined treacle, which, once set, was tougher than cement and more waterproof than tar. Vimes remembered, as a kid, begging chippings of pig treacle off the miners. One lump of that, oozing the sweetness of prehistoric sugarcane, could keep a boy's mouth happily shut for a week. In the same way that ancient forests become coal, ancient swathes of natural sugarcane can become, under the pressures of millennia, what in various parts of the disk is known as hokey-pokey, pig treacle, or rock molasses. But much boiling and purification was necessary to create the thick golden syrup that was the city dweller's honey, and these days Ankh Morpork supplies come from the more accessible toffee beds near Quirm. Inside the treacle-roofed stable level, chewing a bit of bad hay, was the horse. Vimes knew it was a horse because it checked out as one. Four hooves, tail, head with mane, seedy brown coat. Considered from another angle, it was half a ton of bones held together with horsehair. He patted it gingerly. As one of nature's pedestrians, he'd never been at home around horses. He unhooked a greasy clipboard from a nail nearby and flicked through its pages. Then he had another look around the yard. Tilden never did that. He looked at the pigsty in the corner where Nock kept his pig, and then at the chicken run, and the pigeon loft, and the badly made rabbit hutches, and he did a few calculations. The old watch house. It was all there, just like the day he first arrived. It had been two houses once, and one of them had been the treacle mine office. Everywhere in the city had been something else once. And so the place was a maze of blocked-in doorways and ancient windows and pokey rooms. He wandered around like a man in a museum. See the old helmet on a stick for archery practice? See Sergeant Nock's broken springed armchair where he used to sit out on sunny afternoons? And inside the smell. Floor wax, stale sweat, armour polish, unwashed clothes, ink, a hint of fried fish, and always, here, a taint of treacle. The night watch. He was back. When the first members of the night watch came in, they found a man perfectly at ease, leaning back in a chair with his feet on a desk and leafing through paperwork. The man had sergeant stripes and an air of an unsprung trap. He was also giving absolutely no attention to the newcomers. He particularly paid no heed to one gangly lance constable who was still new enough to have tried to put a shine on his breastplate. They fanned out among the desks with muttered conversations. Vimes knew them in his soul. They were in the night watch because they were too scruffy, ugly, incompetent, awkwardly shaped or bloody-minded for the day watch. They were honest in that special policeman sense of the word. That is, they didn't steal things too heavy to carry, and they had the morale of damp gingerbread. He'd wondered last night about giving them some kind of pep talk by way of introduction, and decided against it. They might be very bad at it, but they were coppers, and coppers did not respond well to the happy families approach. "Hello, chaps. Call me Christopher. My door's always open. I'm sure if we all pull together, we shall get along splendidly, like one big happy family." They'd seen too many families to fall for that rubbish. Someone cleared their throat with malice aforethought. Vimes glanced up and into the face of Sergeant Knocker Nock, and, for a fraction of a second, had to suppress the urge to salute. Then he remembered what Nock was. "Well," he said.
"That's my desk you're sitting at, Sergeant," said Nock.
Vimes sighed and pointed to the little crown on his sleeve.
"See this, Sergeant," he said. "It's what they used to call the Hat of Authority."
Nock's little weaselly eyes focused on the crown, and then they went back to Vimes's face and widened in the shock of recognition.
"Bloody hell," breathed Nock.
"That's bloody hell, sir," said Vimes. "But Sarge will do, most of the time."
"And this is your mob, is it? Oh, dear. Well, let's make a start."
He swung his feet off the desk and stood up. "I've been looking at the feed bills for Marilyn," he said. "Interesting reading, lads. According to my rough calculations, a horse eating that much ought to be approximately spherical. Instead, she's so thin that with two sticks and some sheet music, I could give you a tune." Vimes put the papers down. "Don't think I don't know where the corn goes. I bet I know who's got the chickens and rabbits and pigeons," he said. "And a pig. I bet the captain thinks they get fat on leftovers."
"Yeah, but..." a voice began.
Vimes's hand slammed on the desk. "You lot even starve the damned horse," he said. "That stops right now. So will a lot of other things. I know how it works, see? Mumping free beer and a donut, well, that's part of being a copper. And who knows, there might even be a few greasy spoons in this town so happy to see a copper that they will spontaneously offer him a free nosh. Stranger things have happened. But nicking the oats from Marilyn, that stops now. And another thing. Says here that last night the hurry-up wagon had 8 passengers," he said. "2 of them I know about, because one of them must have been me, and I met the other man. The cells are empty this morning. What happened to the other 6? Sergeant Knock?" The sergeant licked his lips nervously.
Dropped them off in Cable Street for questioning, of course," he said, "as per instructions."
"Did you get a receipt?"
"A what?"
"Your men hauled in 6 people who were staying out late, and you handed them over to the unmentionables," said Vimes, with the calm that comes before a storm. "Did they sign for them? Do you even know their names?"
"Orders is just to hand them over," said Knock, trying a little defiance. "Hand them over and come away."
Vimes filed that for future reference and said, "Now, I didn't get taken there because we had a bit of a misunderstanding. And as you can see, it was a bigger misunderstanding than you thought. Because I'm not down in the tanty counting cockroaches, Knock. No, indeed." He took a few steps forward. "I'm standing in front of you, Knock. Isn't that what I'm doing?"
"Yes, Sarge," Knock muttered, pale with fear and fury.
"Yes, Sarge," said Vimes. "But there was another man in the cells and he's gone too. All I want to know is how much and who to. I don't want any looks of cherubic innocence. I don't want any don't know what you're talking about, sir. I just want to know how much and who to." A cloud of red, resentful solidarity settled over the faces in front of him. But he didn't need telling. He could remember. Corporal Quirk always had a private income from bribes. He'd been like Nobby Nobbs without the latter's amiable incompetence. An efficient Nobby, in fact. And you could throw into the mix bullying and brown-nosing and a delight in small evils. Vimes's gaze fell on Quirk and stayed there. "I know you were on a wagon last night, Corporal," he said. "You and Lance Constable, Vimes, it says here." "Not worth worrying if they look a decent sort," Quirk had said. And he'd said, "How can we tell if they're a decent sort, Corp?" "Well, you see how much they can afford." "You mean we let them go if they're rich? Way of the world, lad, way of the world. No reason why we shouldn't get our share, eh? Did you see his money bag? $5 should do it. 4 for me and 1 for you, because you're learning. That's nearly 3 days' pay. It'll cheer up your old mum no end. And where's the loser?"
"But suppose he's nicked the money, Corp?"
"Suppose the moon was made of cheese. Would you like a slice?"
"I think it was $5, Corporal," said Vimes,
and watched the man's lizard eyes flash towards the young Lance Constable. "No. The man in the cell talked," lied Vimes. "Told me I was an idiot not to buy me way out. So, Mr. Quirk, it's like this. They're crying out for good men in the day watch, but if you don't stand too close to light, you might pass. Get along there right now."
"Everybody does it," Quirk burst out. "It's perks,
everybody," said Vimes. He looked around at the squad. "Anyone else here take bribes?" His glare ran from face to face, causing most of the squad to do an immediate impression of the floorboard and ceiling inspector's synchronized observation team. Only 3 members met his gaze. There was Lance Corporal Colon, who could be a little slow. There was a certain Lance Constable whose face was a mask of terror. And there was a dark-haired, round-faced constable who seemed to be puzzled, as if he was trying to remember something,
but who nevertheless stared back with the firm, steady gaze of the true liar.
"Apparently not," said Vimes. Quirk's finger shot out and vibrated in the direction of young Sam Vimes. "He shared it, he shared it," he said. "You ask him." Vimes felt the shock run round the squad. Quirk had just committed suicide. "You hung together against officers, fair enough, but when the jig was up, you did not drop someone in the khaki." They'd laugh at the idea of a watchman's honour, but it did exist in a black and twisty way. "You did not drop your mates in the khaki. And especially, you did not do it to a wet-behind-the-ears rookie who wouldn't know any better." Vimes turned for the first time to the young man he'd been avoiding. "Gods, was I ever that skinny?" he thought. "Did I ever have that much Adam's apple? Did I really try to polish rust?" The young man's eyes were almost back in his head, only the whites showing. "Lance Constable Vimes, isn't it?" he said quietly. "Yes, sir," said Sam hoarsely. "At ease, Lance Constable. Did you, in fact, take a share of the bribe?"
"Yes, sir, a dollar, sir."
"At the instigation of Corporal Quirk?"
Sir?"
"Did he offer it to you?" Vimes translated. Vimes watched his own agony. "You did not drop someone in the khaki." "All right," he said at last. "I'll talk to you later on." "Oh, you still here, Quirk? If you want to complain to the captain, that's fine by me. But if you don't get your stuff out of your locker in 10 minutes, I'll damn well charge you rent." Quirk looked around for immoral support and found none. He'd gone too far. Besides, the watch could see a storm of khaki when it was right overhead and were in no mood to stick their necks out for something like Quirk.
"I will," he said. "I will complain to the captain. You'll see. You'll see. I've got 4 years' good conduct, I have."
"No, that was 4 years not found out," said Vimes. "Clear off."
When Quirk's footsteps had died away, Vimes glared at the squad.
"Good afternoon, lads. My name's John Keel," he said. "We bloody well better get along fine. Now shine up. Captain's inspection in 2 minutes. Off you go. Sergeant Nock, a word, please."
The men dispersed hurriedly. Nock stepped forward, not quite managing to conceal his nervousness. After all, his immediate superior now was a man who, last night, he had kicked in the nadgers. People could hold a grudge about a thing like that. And he'd had time to think.
"I'd just like to say, sir, about last night," he began.
"I'm not bothered about last night," said Vimes.
"You're not?"
"Would you recommend Fred Colon for corporal? I'd value your judgment."
"You would?"
"Certainly. He looks a solid lad."
"He is? I mean, yes, he is. Very thorough," said Nock,
relief rising off him like steam.
"Doesn't rush into things. Wants to join one of the regiments."
"Well, we'll give him a try while we've still got him. That means we'll need another lance corporal. Who was that lad next to Colon?"
"Coates, sir, Ned Coates. Bright lad. Sometimes thinks he knows better, but we were all like that, eh?"
Vimes nodded. His expression completely failed to give away the fact that, as far as he was concerned, there were things clinging to the underside of high branches that knew better than Sergeant Nock.
"A taste of responsibility might do him some good, then," he said.
Nock nodded, because at that point he would have agreed to absolutely anything. And his body language was saying, "We're all sergeants together, right? We're talking about sergeanty things like sergeants do. We're not bothered about anyone being kicked in the nadgers, eh? Not us. "'Cause we're sergeants." His eyes widened, and he saluted as Tilden entered the office. There was some half-hearted saluting amongst the squad, too. The captain acknowledged them stiffly and looked nervously at Vimes.
Sergeant, he said. "Settling in?"
"Yes, sir, no problems.
Well done. Carry on."
When the man had disappeared up the creaking stairs, Vimes turned back to Nock.
"Sergeant, we don't hand over prisoners without a receipt. Understand? Never. What happens to them afterwards, do you know?"
"They get questioned," said Nock. "We takes them up there for questioning."
"What kind of questions? How long it takes two men to dig half a hole?"
"What?"
"From now on, someone at Cable Street signs for prisoners or we bring them right back here," said Vimes. "It's bloody elementary, Sergeant. You hand them over, you get a docket. Don't you do that down at the Tanty?"
"Well, yeah, obviously, but, well, Cable Street, I mean, you don't know what it's like here. I can see that, but with the unmentionables around at Cable Street, it's best not to..."
"Listen, I'm not telling you to kick the door down and shout, 'Put down those thumbscrews,'"
said Vimes. "I'm telling you, we keep track of prisoners. When you arrest a man, you sign him over to Snoutley, don't you? When he leaves, Snoutley or the orderly man signs him out, doesn't he? It's basic custody discipline, man. So, if you hand a prisoner over to Cable Street, someone there gives you a signature. Understand? No one just disappears."
Knock's face showed a man contemplating an immediate future that contained fewer opportunities for personal gain and a greatly raised risk of being shouted at.
"And just to make sure everyone understands, I'll ride the wagon tonight," said Vimes. "But first, I'll take that lad Vimes out for a stroll and shake him up a bit."
"He could do with it," said Knock. "Can't get his mind right. Good with his hands, but you have to tell him everything twice."
"Maybe I'll shout then," said Vimes.
"Vimes!"
Lance Constable Vimes shivered to attention.
"We're going to take a stroll, lad," said Vimes. "Time you knew what's what."
He nodded to Knock, took his younger self by the shoulder, and marched out.
"What do you think, Sarge?"
said Coates, coming up behind Knock as the sergeant glared at the departing back.
"He likes you," said Knock bitterly. "Oh, yes, apple of his eye, you are. You're his old pal. You're being bumped up to Lance Corporal."
"Think he'll last?"
"I'll give him a couple of weeks," said Knock. "I've seen him like that before. Big men in little towns coming here, thinking of the bee's nose. We soon cut him down to size. What do you think?"
"Dunno, Sarge," said Coates.
"Still thinking." "Nosey's coppering, mind you," said Knock. "Bit too cocky, though. He'll learn. He'll learn. There's ways. We'll show him. Take him down a peg. Teach him how he do things around here."